Tereo Ererangi o Te Mania. This episode was produced in Otatahi by Plains Media, with support from New Zealand On Air.
It's time for Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books. Kia ora, everyone. It's Marianne Stone and Maureen Rout here with this week's Bookends. And Maureen, this week we have a deep and meaningful episode.
Yes, about time we did.
All the important things. Starting with Kiwis and Climate by Tessa Vincent. This is a book to get people to the polls on existential issues this year. And then I have also interviewed Jennifer Andrews about pilgrimage. And you don't get more meaningful than that.
Unless you spend a year being a secular priest, which is what Professor Nikki Hare did back in about 2021, I think, and having to contend with COVID at the same time as she was trying to get herself sorted and be present and do the things that a secular priest might do.
My word. Okay, so strap in and be ready to be moved and think deeply. Kiwis and Climate, Voices for Climate Solutions in Aotearoa, New Zealand, is an election year must read. Bookends listeners, yes, beauty and art and the journey of the soul through the page are essential to keep ourselves free when the world is nuts, but sometimes we also need to hear the people of science in action and heed their call to action. I'm joined this morning by the editor of this compendium of perspectives on climate action for Aotearoa, Tessa Vincent. Tēnā koe, ngā mihi for joining us, Tessa, and for all your work on this existential issue.
Kia ora, thanks for having me.
And Tessa, I understand that, in fact, we have pulled you out of a meeting with the former Prime Minister of Aotearoa, Jacinda Ardern, on just this issue. Tell our readers a little bit about, listeners a little bit about what the work we've pulled you from.
Oh, well, we are very excited to have launched a book called Kiwis and Climate. And I can't talk in detail, but we've met with Jacinda to have some awareness about the book. We're meeting politicians across the political aisle. We had the Minister Simon Watts at the event last night in Parliament launching the book. And the intention is to engage with mainstream politicians on this really important issue of climate change that lots of New Zealanders care about, but we seem to have lost sight of that care in the past few years. So this is a new book that celebrates New Zealanders' care for climate action and shows Kiwis working on solutions.
Thank you. Thank you very much. And look, obviously the imperative for climate action is much more pressing than election politics. You know, it's but the timing of the publication was really deliberate, wasn't it? Do you want to talk just a little bit more about that, about what's changed and why you and the other contributors see climate as such a critical issue this year?
Absolutely. Well, 2 years ago, I was feeling a bit disheartened by headlines of New Zealand backtracking on its climate commitments. And at the same time, I was seeing working with New Zealanders around the world who really cared about this issue and who were working on solutions, whether that be in food, education, or transport. And I reached out to a few of them and said, hey, would you be interested in pulling together a book to kind of recenter the opportunities in acting on climate today? And it's really been humbling and a reminder of how New Zealanders are unique, just the goodwill that has come behind this project. So we have 30 Kiwi authors. We've got scientists, farmers, politicians, CEOs, and youth. And they've written about 20 chapters, some are co-authored. And all of these people have written a chapter on the side of busy day jobs completely voluntarily to show Kiwis that there are solutions to the climate crisis. It's not all doom and gloom. In fact, if we act on climate, we can create more jobs in new industries such as clean energy. We can find easier ways to get around, and we can establish healthier, better protected communities. So it's been a real collective effort, and it's an amazing feeling to now, in an election year, get the book out in the world.
So 2 years ago, disheartened on the basis and reheartened by the process of engaging with all these very heartening people, but on the basis of if you were looking at headlines about Aotearoa's positions on climate currently, would you be more or less disheartened than you were 2 years ago?
Well, I'm hopeful that 2026 we can turn things around. So we have seen the government really delay, backtrack on climate policy. That's come in the form of reversing a ban on offshore oil and gas drilling. It's come in the form of lowering methane emission targets, and actually the government is being sued this coming week for relying too much on offset emissions through trees rather than actually reducing emissions. So the story is not that rosy for the government in the past few years. There are a few things that have been, you know, resource consents for energy projects have been made a little easier, which is fantastic. But really my hope is that this book results in stronger political leadership. I think New Zealanders expect more from their political leaders on this issue, and political leaders need to re-engage with the care that many New Zealanders have towards climate action.
Mm. Kia ora. So just briefly, you spoke, you kind of mentioned it, but just briefly, could you talk about selecting the contributors and I guess give us your editor's overview of the book's structure and the rationale that guided it?
Sure. So the book is structured in three sections. So we look at community solutions and education, food, transport, business solutions. So explaining that a lot of climate initiatives can also achieve financial returns. And then the final section of the book is on government solutions. So what kind of leadership do we need this year in an election year? What kind of policies might unlock more innovation in New Zealand and a cleaner future? It's really wide ranging. It was really hard to think, you know, climate intersects with everything. So how do we write this book? But I think having those three sections is really important. It allows a reader to pick up the book and go to a chapter that resonates with them. You know, we've got a chapter on farming the farming community. We've got one on sustainability education for parents and what they can do with working with amazing organisations like the Toi Mata Foundation.
I loved the chapter from the two farmers. In fact, it was really inspiring and you know, just powerful to hear voices coming out of that sector that are so positive about the benefits of farming in sustainable ways. And I found that I found that really beautiful. Each book also finishes with that neat summary. So was that your, and did you do the work of summarising key messages?
Yeah, I did. We've also been supported by Bateman, the publisher, and a fantastic editor, Tracy Borgfeld. But we wanted those key messages to come out in each chapter for busy people who, you know, and for politicians to pick up the book and say, you know, what are the solutions? Often we talk about the doom and gloom that surrounds climate change, but here we really want to flip the problem of climate change into a solution the farming chapter, as you say, that's lovely to hear. It does a great job of that by talking about ecological farming, working with nature, and introducing plant varieties and reducing synthetic fertilizers. There's lots we can do. A lot of the solutions already exist, and hopefully this book instills a bit of hope through providing those tangible solutions.
Yeah, sure. I personally found it a very optimistic and hopeful read. But I also think that, you know, that introductory setup to it with the Jim Salinger giving us the understanding about impacts, the you know, plausible futures based on degrees of warming, it really does help to set up the sense of urgency about that. And I guess there's this idea of there's still people, some of our listeners might still be contending with people who say the climate isn't set, the climate science isn't settled, you know, and human impact. And so it's kind of is important to still start there, but to move beyond that. And I think the book achieves that. Was that really deliberate to kind of not to, to set it up right, but not to give all the space and attention to that?
Absolutely. I think you need to center the science, but we didn't want to get bogged down in the science. And actually, climate denialism it's very few people now, but the problem we have is delay.
Yeah.
So we're delaying action, and we need that across transport, agriculture, energy. Those are three big hitting sectors that require communities, but also political and business leaders to turn things around.
Yeah.
So that's why we brought in different sectors and different expertise across the board.
Yeah. I was struck, as ever, by the voice of youth activists early in the book, and in particular by their kind of instinctive acceptance and perfect articulation of solidarity. As you know, it's Sophie Hanford, one of the activists, young activists, says, "Your struggle is my struggle, your well-being my well-being," and it's so critical to this area. Why is it that youth are so connected to that message in a way that you know, that they're not distracted by splinting nationalism, you know, and all of that? They kind of really get it. How you know, do you want to talk? Could you talk to our listeners about that, about the voice of young people and where they're coming from?
Sure. That chapter is co-written by Sophie Hanford and an amazing young Pacifica woman, Mary Moenol Kolio. And it was the one chapter, I'll be honest, that made me get teary. I think it's a really beautiful piece on the friendship between a young white woman, young Pacific woman, and their incredible advocacy work, from a fossil fuel phase-out treaty to the school strikes for climate back in 2019. You know, this is an issue that a lot of young people have a lot of anxiety around. And we wanted to, with the book, really center the opportunities for rangatahi in new career opportunities. So there's also a chapter on work and climate. And we wanted to center the youth voices to really center what's at stake. And I think they've done a beautiful job in that chapter of explaining, youth perspectives and also their willingness to just get on with it, to work across different cultures and to put at the heart of our climate response those who are most vulnerable, which is youth and which is our Pacific neighbours.
Yeah, for sure. Yes, me too. Got weepy in that one, and that theme of solidarity just being so good to hear people talking about as a central theme on climate. There was another theme about staying optimistic, and you've mentioned that a little bit as the rationale behind that. But that idea of living and growing a collective vision that people just love to buy into. So what I thought about when I was reading that is there like a global or a New Zealand climate action comms strategy that centres that? You know, because it comes through really clearly in the book, and it does seem like a really important thing to be uplifting about this journey, even though it seems really tough and change is slow.
Oh, thank you for picking that up. I engaged with two main communications experts, a few other people as well, but I'll highlight Pip Wheaton and Jessica Berenson-Shaw. And I really loved their suggestions of actually New Zealanders care about climate action because we care about the people and the places that we want to protect. So it's really centering first our care for climate action. And I think for too long, those of us working in the space, including myself, have done it a disservice by focusing on targets and reducing greenhouse gas emissions. And yes, that is what we want to do, but why do we want to do it? We want to protect, you know, we saw this with the landslide and during summer this year and the storms. We want to better protect our people and we want to plan for the future. You probably have seen The Ford by Eliza McCartney, but those two pages really are the heart of the book. It's about, you know, why do we care about climate? Why does Eliza McCartney, an Olympic pole vaulter, care about this issue? And we hope that the book is something that all New Zealanders can pick up and relate to and engage with.
Yeah, that bursts of optimism, and the book is full of them, and they're all very grounded in fact and in action. And that was one of the things, the other theme of the book that comes through really strongly is, there's a quote in there, what's missing isn't positive or negative framing, but agency. And so, you know, we've had this kind of focus on optimism, but then the book also gives us a whole lot of great ways to think about individual contribution. And I'd love to hear you talking about that, but there's so much to talk about. We're kind of limited for time. I wondered if there's a passage that you feel best sums up the kind of call to action, and could we finish with a reading?
Absolutely. I'll read from Eliza McCartney's Ford. She's been brilliant, and I think this sums it up. So this book is for all New Zealanders. It's for our farming community who know their land better than anyone. It's for the rangatahi wanting to align their careers with climate action. It's for the entrepreneurs wanting to shape a clean energy future. It's a tribute to the many New Zealanders who are already taking action. It's for anyone who loves this place we call home.
Kia ora, and thank you, Eliza, for your contribution. Ngā mihi, Tessa Vincent, and all the doers and writers who contributed to this excellent, accessible book, Kiwis in Climate, published by Bateman Books. Buy it, talk about it, get involved, vote with your awareness of this most critical existential issue and with your aroha for Aotearoa guiding your ballot. Aotearoa and the planet, I should say, guiding your ballot. Thank you so much.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Professor Nikki Hare is a community psychologist and she's head of the School of Psychology at the University of Auckland, Waipapa Taumata Row. She spent a year exploring what the secular world can learn from a religion, and her account of this is just out now. It is The Calling. Nikki, welcome to Bookends. Great to have you here. And thank you for doing doing the work for us, the mahi for us, and providing us with this particularly provocative and thoughtful book. First of all, I think we need to know what drew you to the project and why you chose the role of a priest.
Well, it all started with a conversation I had with someone when I was in the Netherlands, where we both confessed to each other that we thought deep down inside we really were priests, even though I was a university lecturer and she was a facilitator and we were both atheists. And it's a little bit hard to remember exactly what I was thinking back then because I've learned so much since then. But I think to me the role of a priest is somebody who holds the person in front of them or the people in front of them, but also holds everything else, our common lives together, the natural planet. Of course, from a religious perspective, it's also God, which we could call something like the unity that is all. So I was really attracted to doing both of those things at the same time.
And you had this year, this, the sabbatical year, and you could have used it in many ways, but you clearly felt a calling to do this.
Yeah, well, I mean, sabbatical is such an enormous privilege as an academic to be able to explore something in depth. So I'm a community psychologist, so I learn by doing. So I decided that I both wanted to investigate a religion and really live into it as best I could for the year. And Christianity was the obvious choice because it's the religion of my heritage and culture. And I also wanted to put into practice what I was learning, which is why I set myself up as a secular priest. So it was a role that I made up. I offered services. I offered personal conversations, which I considered conversations about how to deepen our contribution to common life. And I also offered ceremonies and did one fabulous baby naming ceremony during the year. Well, I thought it was fabulous. I had a lot of fun anyway.
Well, it sounded like everybody else did too. Yeah. You were brought up as an atheist. You're not like me, you know, somebody who was forced along to church all my young teenage life and just got thoroughly bored and very suspicious of what I was being told.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's such an important comment because being raised atheist, I didn't come into this with, if you like, baggage. I was really prepared to sort of be open to and learn from religion and people practicing a liberal type of Christianity, if you like. Whereas as I was going on in the project, I realised a lot of people have deliberately left the church and there's a lot of pain there. And I found some of those people pretty resistant to what I was putting forward. Whereas I thought active practicing Christians would think I was this outrageous interloper daring to call myself a priest. But in fact, they were incredibly warm and encouraging. So it's quite interesting the different ways in which people view religion.
It is indeed. I remember reading one of Lloyd Gehring's later books, you know, much later after he was famously head up for his views. But, you know, yeah. I kept thinking if I'd heard this as a young person, as an inquiring mind, I might have been more likely, I don't think I would have stayed a Christian, but I would have, you know, it kept some sort of sense of the divine, of the unknown, of the mystery.
Yeah, I know exactly what you mean, because for me it is these intellectually troublesome pieces, you know, stories of fantastical events like Jesus rising from the dead or Mary being a virgin when Jesus was born. And all religions have these fantastical stories that are this block to this massive wisdom that's held within in religions about the unknown, about humility, about being good to other people. So I think I'm not sure how old you are, Maureen, but me, oh. I'm 64.
I'm quite a bit older than you, yeah.
So, well, the era we grew up in, it was really focused on belief, you know, do you believe this or do you not believe this? And that was the core. And for me, as a young person with atheist parents, there's no way I could possibly believe, because if I did, all my family was going to hell. Well, that wasn't going to sit well with me. But now, you know, the church that I went to and the experiences I have, at least the Christians I mix with, are no longer talking about hell. There's not a sense of a God that chooses. At all, actually, let alone based on belief.
Yeah, not that demonic person who's watching your every move and you're going to be cast into outer darkness. How does one go about setting themselves up as a priest?
Well, how I did it was that I set up a website called secularpriest.org, and I advertised my services, so I held them at the community centre near my home. I ran them 3 Sundays a month for, it was in the end, about 10 months at 5 p.m. And then there was an online version Wednesdays at 7 a.m. that was a bit shorter but repeated the theme of the Sunday before. And I also advertised the personal conversations and ceremonies. I took a course with the New Zealand Celebrant School in order to get a little bit of a sense of what a celebrant does. And then I have networks because I've done a lot of work on values-based practice and being at the university, you know, I'm engaged with different circles. So I really just sent out notice to my networks that I was doing this and invited people to join in.
And you had a surprising reaction from people that you thought might take an interest.
Correct. I thought, for a long time, I've thought that we needed symbolism and reflection in the sort of broadly speaking environmental social justice circles, that we needed to not put people against the natural environment and that we needed to integrate our sense of how to live well into our actual everyday lives. So I thought the Secular Priest Project would be offering that to people I mixed with, which a lot of which were community-based environmental activists, is a strong word, you know, people doing things like stream cleanups and so on. But those people stayed away. I got almost no interest from that group of people.
And not even any response to say thanks, but thanks.
Not even any.
Yeah,
not even any response. I mean, it was as if I actually think I had used words that had a power I was unaware of. Nobody said to me directly that they were offended by my use of the word priest, but people did say to me, oh, priest, oh, sermon, not sure you want to use those terms. and I just kind of blithely went ahead and then got this huge shock when I sent an email to 29 people that I knew well that lived locally, expecting them to just jump on board, and actually none of those people ever attended one of my services. So I had to kind of rethink where I was going with this.
And being
early on.
Yes, and being a priest, Nikki, you couldn't take it personally, could you? You had to.
I could not. Oh, and in fact, what's kind of interesting about the writing of this book is I've tried really, really hard in the way I've written it. I don't know how well I've succeeded in trying to have that generosity of perspective. So the passage where I describe sending out an email to these 29 people, closing my computer, confident I'd get replies, opening it 2 hours later, nothing, 2 days later, still nothing. I write in there, and this is sincere, you know, how I still value the friendship of these people. It was really disconcerting. But I was determined in this book, like you say, to be priestly about the whole thing, to let people go, to let people be who they needed to be, and not have to explain themselves to me.
You lived, you say, that it was the life that you chose to lead at that stage. You say it was liberating to have a year of deliberately constraining and directing your actions and choices.
Yeah, well, I had three vows, you see. Priests have to have vows. And my vows were simplicity, in which I wore a uniform all year. The uniform was basically grey and black clothes. I was not allowed to buy anything non-essential, which was defined as needed for my basic life. So I could buy food and painkillers and dishwashing liquid. If, say, something like my cell phone broke, I could buy a new one. Nothing like that happened, but nothing that I didn't need. Then I had a vow of hospitality, which meant that I had to greet people when being out and about and be open to people's invitation, which was quite a challenge for me as an introvert. And finally, I had a vow of pause, which was about taking time out to reflect. And even though I struggled with the idea hugely at the beginning, I ended up developing a meditation routine, which was how I enacted my vow of pause. And so that gave my life this huge structure for a year. Like, not buying anything was just wonderful. It was so easy. I almost didn't even remember that I'd made the vow. and having pauses, you know, doing meditation, and I did a three-day silent retreat and other things around that. Spaciousness is currently one of my favourite words. Getting that bit of space between you and the things you're concerned about is just so important to being a well-functioning, generous person, which I felt that I was able to sort of gradually step into as the year went on.
But, of course, the necessity of pausing and taking time and being in a different space was exaggerated. It was forced upon you because COVID interrupted this year, didn't it?
It did. And actually, there's quite a bit in the book about COVID, because for one of the things that happened was that I had these in-person Sunday services and they had to stop. In fact, my very first scheduled in-person Sunday service was 2 days after Jacinda Ardern and Ashley Bloomfield said there would be a lockdown in Auckland for, I think initially it was for a week. So my first Sunday service was off because of that. That lockdown lasted about 3 weeks and I held off on services until it was over. But at the end of the year, when we had that really, really long Auckland lockdown, I just shifted everything online. So it's quite interesting reflecting back on 2021 and how that affected us all. And many people got a break during that time. I don't want to in any way underplay the sort of economic difficulties and the schooling issues and everything. But it was a kind of collective pause for many of us in some ways.
And for many people, they look back on it with a sense wishing they could have that imposed
nostalgia
upon them again. Yes, nostalgia.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah. Mm. I mean, I remember that first one, which was in 2020, and I had an interview with somebody you might have read where she was describing, you know, what Auckland was like in that first lockdown at around Easter. The weather was beautiful, and there was just this calmness and quietness. And, I mean, I was worried about the economy at the time, so there was that anxiety, and I know that was way worse for people in small businesses and so on. But at the same time, that sense that life doesn't have to be so complicated was present.
Yeah. We're probably running out of time to go into the whole the other huge thing that happened to your position and your and really confronted you with choices that had to be made was the letter to the listener by seven of your colleagues that I remember really well. I get the listener, so I read the letter and then followed the fallout from that. I think, you know, that's probably too big a thing to try and cover now, but it's very well covered in the book. And I think when I ask you to reflect on what not really what you learned from that, but what remains with you. I think you can probably bring some of that in. I mean, relate to that.
Yeah, I think the fallout from the listener letter was really disconcerting for me, because I knew two of the authors really well, and it showed me how quickly people can move together, essentially to condemn other people. And it's a really complicated situation, because I know that the people who were speaking out against what the authors had offered felt they were doing it in order to protect more vulnerable people. I completely accept that that was happening. But what it really taught me is that we haven't learnt how to do civil discourse well in the university or in the country as a whole. People really quickly took sides, and it became really difficult to have dialogue across sides. So as a community psychologist, I've always been very interested in how you bring together different parts of the community to work together, because in my mind, having this history in environmentalism and issues like climate change, what it's going to take is us banding together as community and looking after each other. And I learnt from my interaction and friendship with Christians how it's possible to hold quite a different worldview and belief about the truth, but not use it as a shield to block other people, to send them away. So the whole listener letter saga made me think, how do we accept that we have different viewpoints and beliefs, but still be in relationship to each other? And that's still something I'm really struggling with and really interested in continuing, is crossing those divides across really controversial issues like that.
Yes, you talk a lot about how it's essential to listen to one another. And, you know, I think you end with, and we're going to have to end, with, you know, retaining a sense of awe at the world, of enjoying the mystery of and the enchantment of the natural world.
Yeah, I experienced this thing, which I called a strange new feeling of happiness, which was, you could call it a sense of grace, a sense of being in the present. I even sort of jokingly say that I was enlightened for the time, because I really was living in the present. And if you're able to do that, there's just this huge sense of gratitude and generosity and openness to other people, which I think it's really hard to achieve, but I think it's something that the major faiths are orienting towards and trying to practice in themselves, which is one of the key lessons I got from this whole project.
Well, thank you for, as I say, for doing the work on our behalf. For writing,
thank you, Lauren.
For writing it down so well, so clearly, but it is full, chock full of references to lots of texts and lots of thoughts, lots of interesting conversations that you've had. I can thoroughly recommend The Calling by Nikki Hare, which is published by Auckland University Press.
You're listening to Bookends on Plains Media, broadcasting on 96.9 FM, streaming live and available as a podcast on plains.org.nz.
Six or maybe 7 years ago now, Jennifer Andrews got told by her physician that a Parkinson's diagnosis would mean she might have 5 able-bodied years left. Heading into her 5th and still very well, she decided to walk the Via Francigena, 2,417 kilometres from Canterbury Cathedral in the south of England to Rome. 99 days walking. The maths gives me about 25 kilometres a day, but many days were longer. South through France, across the Alps, into northern Italy, and so on, through landscapes soaked in history and often rain, to the tomb of St. Peter. Staying largely in pilgrim hostelry and learning the steadying lessons of pilgrimage, which she shares in her memoir, The Only Way Is Up. a through-walk memoir that is both usefully pragmatic and richly contemplative. Jennifer joins me this morning on Bookends. Hello, bonjour, ciao, and tenakwe, Jennifer. Thanks for joining us.
Kia ora, bonjour. Thanks for having me.
So, your book starts with a section from Raina Maria Rilke's poem, The Panther. Could you read us that section and talk to us about what the panther, as it appears in that piece of that poem, symbolised for you at the outset of your journey?
Sure. So the excerpt reads, "His vision from the constantly passing bars has grown so weary that it cannot hold anything else. It seems to him there are 1,000 bars, and behind the bars, no world." And really for me, that I've included that excerpt because it was very meaningful for me. It was something that I had come across in the context of actually doing a virtual version, a representative virtual version of the Via Francigena during COVID. And obviously that was timely in the context of those feelings during COVID of being very much trapped. And for me, being doubly trapped because COVID coincided with my diagnosis and my neurologist telling me, you know what, you've got maybe limited time. You know, it's a bit how long is a piece of string, but if there are things that you want to do, you should go do them. And then the world shut down. And I felt like actually I was just trapped. It was very apt.
Well, we visit the panther, obviously, but that's a great place to start with this feeling of trapped. And I guess one of the questions that I have remaining after reading the book was that apart from that kind of impending shutting down of possibility, in fact, Parkinson's doesn't show up much in the book. You credit the walking with so much benefit for flexibility of mindset and strengthening your body. They're obviously critical for managing Parkinson's. So maybe you didn't have that many symptoms, but I was really curious, do you mind talking a little bit about how the symptoms did show up on your pilgrimage?
Yeah, absolutely. I deal with a few symptoms of it. The reality is, you know, I'm living with it from day to day, and it is a progressive condition. So I'm not going to lie, it's there, and it is slowly getting worse. But the aim with anything that I do, including the walking, is to ward off that progression, to slow it down, and to manage it so that I can live my life as much as I can. And the predominant symptom that I have is a tremor. So that for me started in the left hand and progressed through the left hand side, and it's still predominantly in the left hand side. And so I have a range of ways of managing that, and that's something which I did also experience and do also experience while walking. But interestingly, and you know, to some extent, to your point, I definitely don't experience that and the various other minor symptoms as much when I am walking as when I am not. So for me, to some extent, it is almost like I don't have it when I'm walking. So it's interesting that you've read that into it, that it sort of doesn't show up. And to some extent, that is very much true. It doesn't show up for me as much.
And joyful.
So it's just not predominant.
That must be a very joyful part of the walking.
And you
started there just with a touch of, and the memoir gives us the history of how you settled on walking this path, COVID, the virtual walking group, all those things. But there's one moment in the book where you stay a night in a hostel that housed the cardinal whose writing first documented this journey as a whole. And that really fired up my imagination. And I wondered if you could tell listeners a brief history of the Via Francigena itself.
Yes. So, look, it's it has been developed around a narrative of the journey of an early archbishop from Canterbury, Archbishop Sigeric.
Not Carter. Who travelled
to Rome back in the day to collect his vestments is the way it goes.
Right.
Now, whether he actually went on foot or in a carriage, by the way, you know, we don't know, but actually that's kind of probably appropriate too because people use all sorts of means. But in any case, he was one of the first who documented his return on a route from Rome to Canterbury over 80 sections. And those sections, you know, were documented and archived and have more recently been brought back out of the archive and a trail or connecting network of trails as closely to that route as possible has been developed.
Very cool. Yeah. Thank you. Thanks for that. It was, just a moment that fired my imagination. So then you divide this book and, in fact, the experience of pilgrimage itself into three sections, the mind, the body, and the heart. You refer to them variously, but I think that's those three. It works really neatly with the stages of this journey, the way that you describe it, your journey. Can you explain the significance for listeners of those three stages?
Yeah, so it is something which, I just realised really in the course of walking this route more than any other that I've done, just really came together and was meaningful for me. Pilgrims do tend to generally refer to the Camino as rolling out in those three stages, mental, physical, and spiritual. Typically in the context of the Camino Francés, which is the classic Camino that people are talking about when they're talking about Camino across the north of Spain. In my case, I had experienced that to some extent on my previous walks across France, but this one really felt like it did align very definitely in a particular order. So the first stage, very much a mental stage, getting your head in the game, that first kind of third, walking predominantly across France, very challenging. I was walking most of that by myself, long days, long stretches without access to resources, you know, being the only person in an accommodation. And it was really, it was a mental game, you know, it's all about mindset, you know, it's not just about the physical walking.
Nobody's going to come and rescue me.
No, that's right. You've got to do what you're going to do with your wits and what's in your backpack, you know. And that's really empowering and liberating, actually. And that's an important part of the package. And then the second stage, you know, for me on the French Agitator did coincide with being very much a physical challenge. So that's the stage where, you know, you've been walking mostly on flat or rolling landscapes, and albeit it's a mental game, it's relatively easy walking. And then suddenly you arrive actually at the mountainous stretch from kind of the east of France well into Italy over the Apennines a long way. And, intensely physical despite the warm-up of like 7 weeks of walking across France. Suddenly it's all uphill. And so that in my mind was a very physical section. And then having gone through all of that, into the last, you know, sort of home stretch, if you like, of 6 weeks of walking down through Tuscany and Lazio to Rome, everything else is just kind of in this rhythm. You know, you've got your head in the game, you're putting one foot in front of the other, you know what you're doing when you get up in the morning, your legs are warmed up, your body's in tune, and you get to this really spiritual, philosophical aspect of Camino walking, which is probably the bit that is greater than the sum of its parts.
You described that somewhere as page 192, the mind has learned to rest, the body has learned its rhythm, and what remains is the task of the spirit to make sense of it all, to find the coherence between what has been endured and what has been gained. Which I thought was really beautiful. And so it does lead on to that question about, so what is it that you gained from this pilgrimage in particular, Jennifer? And just, it comes through in the book, by the way, listeners, but as a taster for listeners, talk about what you gained from this.
Yeah, just incredible insights. It's hard to articulate that into a short narrative, but the fact of walking, you know, those day in, day out, you know, for almost 100 days, you become very in tune with yourself and, you know, on a number of levels. So for a start, you know, I always like to think, well, it's phenomenal for me in particular that actually after more than 5,000 kilometres walking now in total, you know, blister-free, injury-free, illness-free. And I think that's because, largely because I know my body through walking. You know, I know every part of it. I know how it works together. It knows me. I know what I can ask of it. I know what happens to it when I push it too far. So, you know, that's really powerful. I think equally, you just become very in tune with your mind. Very in tune. You get beyond, you know, kind of beyond your thoughts. Very much on the course of day to day, you know, our thoughts are very cluttered. You know, there's all these layers of things that we're thinking that we think are important and really aren't. And when you're just walking, your backpack and your wits on the road, you tap into that inner resilience and clarity actually that is there all along, but that you don't actually see. And that's very, very powerful.
Yeah, the structure of the book, it's daily walking rhythm and, you know, and then just that like accommodation, friendships, mud, rain, mosquitoes, urgent need for food, all of that kind of daily stuff, the joy of washing machines. It fascinates me how differently it works reading this book than reading fiction or other memoir, right? And it's also expected and kind of largely uneventful. So why should it be interesting? And yet the reader's mind becomes stilled by it in the same way that you're describing as in The Pilgrimage. And I think that that's quite a beautiful and remarkable thing to have achieved. It opens you. So thanks. And I guess there's not too much of a question in that. But one thing that I wondered about it was, were you nervous as a writer about reflecting just again and again and again on the small joys and wins? Was it a struggle to connect each day to something meaningful to talk about?
Yeah, to some extent. And I mean, it's really interesting. I mean, on a number of levels, certainly that's something which I've struggled with since way back. I've always journaled, like when I've travelled. That was something that particularly my mum instilled in us when we were kids, and we always did it reluctantly, you know, when we travelled. Oh, Mom, do we have to do the diary, really? You know, I just want to do something else. And every day I'd write, you know, and it would come down to got up, had breakfast, went to school, came home, had dinner. Boring, right? You know, and so, yeah, on the Camino, I mean, I've adapted, obviously, that journaling. And for me, it is essentially journaling to provide kind of prompt and memory, which is fantastic. But every day I would come to do my Facebook post journal at the end of the day. And I would think to myself, well, you know, what am I going to possibly write today that is going to be different from yesterday? Because you know, it's literally got up, had breakfast, stuck my pack on, went for a walk, found some food, had a shower, ate, went to bed. Boring. But every day I would get to the end of it, and one way or the other, I would start writing and something different would come out. And for me, I think the insight there is that, yeah, the writing is very much part of the pilgrimage process for me. It's part of processing what is going on during the day. I mean, partly because I don't note take in writing while I'm walking. It's all in my head. But I'm thinking constantly, I'm observing things. Sometimes I'm semi-rehearsing in my head, you know, what I'm thinking and how that might translate. And then actually putting it down, pen to paper, so to speak, at the end of the day is kind of, yeah, therapeutic. It's part of pulling out of the long tail process of pulling the threads of the experience together. And it goes on, you know, even now. And so actually writing the book, you know, from the core of those rough journal entries, you know, at even a later stage, that's again another layer of processing through writing. And sometimes, I've only noticed actually the connections, and particularly the panther connection. I actually only realised how momentous that panther connection was for me when writing the book some 6 to 9 months after having finished The Pilgrimage. It hadn't even dawned on me.
Although you do, it does dawn on you gradually to the point that you finish with commemorating the pilgrimage by marking yourself with a tattoo. Yes. And I wonder whether that was going to be my final question. So it feels so different at the end, the panther, than that caged panther from Rilke's poem. And so I want you to tell us about marking yourself and why and what it came to mean to you.
Yeah, it was this curious thing. I mean, I very much had started out with this concept of panther, but it was kind of there. I mean, it had been there in the virtual Camino, prompted by this kind of, you know, poem and think piece. So it was kind of there. And then I'd kind of forgotten about it. And then I started walking, and just coincidentally, by the by, in a disconnected way, little references to panther kept popping up, you know, randomly. You know, we would just see, I would see, you know, leopard skin, you know, clothing in the shops. And it just kept appearing, and it became a bit of a theme and a bit of a thing. And, and then along the way, I just realised actually panther is kind of, there's something in that, you know, and I started processing, I was prompted to process actually back to that poem. I suppose I reconnected with that in that concept of being trapped, and was ruminating, did a lot of ruminating along about that. And at the same time, I was trying to unpick in my brain, okay, what is this, why is the pilgrimage so good for me, you know, mentally, physically, and spiritually, what is that? What is in that package? And how can I unravel that in such a way that I can actually replicate that in normal daily life? Because, right, like, you can't walk 365 days of the year, 30 Ks a day in Europe. It's not sustainable. And so these two things gradually came together in my mind, but hadn't really coalesced. And then we walked into Siena. I was with a walking companion, and we walked into Siena, and Siena has neighbourhoods with mottos and you know, representative icons, and we came across in a street corner a statue of a panther with just this incredible statement below it, in Italian, "My momentum overcomes all obstacles," with a panther, and the light bulb just went off, and I thought, wow, you know, I was almost frozen. It gives me goosebumps even now, because it's momentum. It's not fear. It's not actually being caged. It's helping me move forward.
Beautiful, and beautifully described, and also just and from the book. There's so much in the book. But we do need to draw our discussion to a close. So thanks again for joining us, Jennifer. We didn't get onto your beautiful Camino friendships. And so I just want to shout out to all those people who helped you along the way, because their stories are also told, and you give them some great lines. The book is The Only Way Is Up, On Foot to Rome by Jennifer Andrews. It's published by Parallel Lives. It's available online and at bookstores nationwide.
And join us, Marianne Stone and Maureen Rath, on Bookends, sponsored by Scorpio Books, next Tuesday on Plains Media.